Hello, thank you for tuning in. You are listening to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. For network or show information, visit biteradio.me or call 843-808-0777. And now, the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Good day, everyone, and thank you for joining this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Today, my special guest is Dr. Stephen G. Post. He is author of God and Love on Route 80, The Hidden Mystery of Human Consciousness. A story of faith, love, and destiny for everyone on a spiritual journey. God and Love on Route 80 is a highly entertaining, true story of a cross-country road trip and a spiritual journey that led one young man to the discovery that a powerful force carries us toward our destinies. Many scriptures teach of an eternal, infinite mind beyond space and time that creates and sustains the universe. The divine mind whispers and winks at us as we move through our everyday lives to reassure us that the journey is meaningful at all, even when we stumble. Dr. Stephen G. Post is a best-selling author also of Why Good Things Happen to Good People, How to Live Longer, Happier, and Healthier Life by the Simple Act of Giving. Okay, you can find out more about Dr. Stephen Post by visiting one of two websites. You can visit his website, which is stephengpost.com, and you can also website unlimitedloveinstitute.org, and we'll be talking about the Unlimited Love Institute later on in the show. So with that, I'd like to welcome Stephen. So good day, sir.
Good day, Robert. Nice to be with you.
Thank you. I'm happy to have you here and chatting with us, and I love hearing personal stories of people with love and synchronicity and destinies and all that kind of thing, because I just think that the more we raise awareness of that fact of life, I think the happier we'll be. So let's start with God and Love on Route 80. So can you share with us how that all started? Was it the Blue Angel that maybe was the seed for that?
Sure, I'd be happy to, Robert. This begins when I was 15 years old. I was a student at a prep school in Concord, New Hampshire, called St. Paul's School. And I had a lot of interest in spiritual classics and philosophy and Siddhartha and spiritual journeys. And when I was at that age, I had a dream. It would be early in the morning. I wasn't sure if I was quite awake or quite asleep. And simply stated, I would see a very thick silvery mist covering some road to the west. I would see then the facial outline of a young man with blonde stringy hair leaning out off a ledge as if to jump. Then the mist would dissipate, and I would see the face of a blue angel. I didn't believe in angels, by the way, at the time. And in a feminine voice, the angel said to me, "If you save him, you too shall live." And then the angel disappeared. The dream was over. And since we had 8 o'clock required chapel, it was an Episcopal high school, I would go early and meditate on the dream, and the dream recurred about a half dozen times over a little more than a year. So I wasn't sure if it was significant or not. I didn't know how to think about such a dream, but intuitively I felt that maybe it was some infinite or universal mind, call it God, call it supreme being, what you want, kind of trying to break through my worldly consciousness with some kind of a call.
Oh, well, now you said at the time that you didn't believe in angels. So when this happened, did you go to anyone to try to make sense out of it? And when was it that you felt that maybe there was, as you went through those many experiences with the same dream, at what point did you feel that there was that significance, some significance behind it?
Well, I talked about it with some of my friends up there, but I also had a really great ancient history, sacred studies teacher, professor, an Episcopal priest who was a friend of Alan Watts, and a Yale Div School graduate. His name was Rod Wells. I would talk with Rod about this. He was a bit of a Jungian. He was interested in dreams. He took adolescent spirituality seriously, whereas most people kind of put it off on the shelf as kind of silly. And in fact, we drove up. We drove down from Concord. I'm in New York now, so I'm thinking up, but we drove down from Concord,
right,
New Hampshire,
right,
to New Haven, Connecticut, first time there, and with Rod. And I actually presented about my dream at a seminar on adolescent spirituality with a really well-known psychologist of religion named Jim Diddes. There were about 15 divinity students there, and they asked me about the dream, and I told them about it, and they asked me what it meant, and I told them that, well, we all read Emerson's Oversoul up there in New Hampshire, but no one really believes it except me, and that I thought this idea of a universal mind that we all participate in, a kind of a one-mind idea, made a whole lot of sense. And then they asked me, so what was I going to do with it? And I said, well, I'm not sure, but I did apply out west to a college where no St. Paul's kid ever applies, Reed College in Portland, Oregon. And so clearly it meant something to me. And I wasn't sure what. I wasn't sure if it was real or not, if it was just a kind of, the result of some anxiety, some concoction that young people make up in a desperate search for meaning. So I wasn't sure.
I mean, it's one of those that, it's so broad or esoteric that, it could apply to so many possibilities. There's so many possibilities that one could, play a part in that. I'm sure that would have been hard to nail down. Let's tell us then how the road trip started and let's talk about that.
Well, yeah, that's the key, So I was actually got into Swarthmore. I was headed for Swarthmore. That's around Philadelphia for college. And that summer, I was just 17. My sacred studies teacher, Rod Wells, had gotten me a nice job tutoring in the Bronx. I'd done that with French Canadian kids in New Hampshire, and I liked it a lot. It was gratifying. So my parents in New York, they put their feet down. They said, no, you can't do that. It can't be in the Bronx. It's too dangerous. Maybe it was. I didn't think so. But we argued about it for a couple of days. And finally, my mom said, well, we're not going to be supporting you for college if you absolutely insist on this. And so I thought that was pretty extreme, and I told them that, but I did relent. And I said, okay, so now where am I going to go to work for the summer? I need a job. And my dad was the president of W&J Sloan's department store on Fifth Avenue. And so he knew like all the furniture manufacturers, lamp manufacturers across all of greater New York. So he said, why don't you work in Bill DeBono's lampshade factory. I had once met Bill De Bono. He had a factory in Patchogue on the South Shore of Long Island.
Oh, yeah.
So I said I'd give it a try, and I actually drove out there in my dad's secondhand gray Mercedes 190, which had seen a lot better days. He had another car that was the family vehicle, but this was around for show and tell. And so I would drive out to the factory, and I worked good long days. I cut cardboard. Bill would supervise me with his cigar burning, and I had two big Italian women, wonderful women, on either side of me. Smoking away. There was no air conditioning, so I was cutting cardboard. And after a couple of weeks of this, on a Friday night, I decided in my own mind, you know, this is it. I'm not going to do this anymore. So I drove the Mercedes out east on Long Island to a little town called West Hampton Beach, which was kind of a hangout. And I had a couple of friends who lived out there. And lo and behold, about 11 that night, with my copy of Siddhartha in my pocket, with my classical guitar, with about $50, I told my friends that I was driving west to follow the dream. And they were a little shocked, but I said, that's what I'm doing. Of course, there was also the push, you know, there was the pull of the dream and the push, which was maybe even more significant of, you know, the acrimony at home and also being sick and tired of the lampshade factory. So I just drove west on the Sunrise Highway. I drove through the Midtown Tunnel. I drove up the FDR over the George Washington Bridge. I'd never driven west of the bridge before, but as soon as I got off the bridge, there were basically two signs. So one, Robert, said 95 South. The other said Route 80 West. And since West was the dream, I was taking Route 80. And that changed my life right there. So I drove, you know, 4 or 5 hours. I wound up smack dab in the middle of Pennsylvania, you know, somewhere around Lewisburg. And I was thinking, you know, it was just pre-dawn. I'm going to turn around. I'm going to make a turn over the Midway and go home, and no one will ever know the difference. I still had enough money to get back for gas. But lo and behold, just as I was thinking that, the generator broke. And, you know, back in those days, every car had a generator. And that's when the generator stopped, the electricity went completely dead. All the lights were off. The engine stopped dead. And you were just basically finished. And so that happened. I was totally shocked. It was a stick shift. So I was able to just coast over to the right shoulder of the highway. And I looked around me. Just, again, you know, early dawn, pre-dawn. And all I could see was, you know, fields, miles of fields, you know, corn and wheat, no telephone booths, nothing. So I did the only thing that a kid could do. I took a piece of paper out of the glove compartment, and I wrote a note that's in the book, actually, God and Love on Route 80. The note said, to the Pennsylvania State Police, please return this car to Henry A.V. Post, 44 Davison Lane East, West Islip, New York, and then our number, 516-669-5655, from his son, who no longer works in the lampshade factory. And this is a bit of a confession. So I, you know, there was a little bit of light coming up now, and I just stepped out of the car, and I had my guitar, again, my $50, and my copy of Siddhartha in my pocket. Put my thumb out, and immediately a big, huge white truck came by. A guy stopped, flung open his door, and he said, my name's Gary, where are you going? And I said, west. And he said, well, I can get you to Chicago. And, you know, that's a long story, but I got to Lincoln, Nebraska, I called my mom at the suggestion of a hippie gal, and I called collect from a telephone booth, and my mom said, hey, Stevie, you're alive. We can call off the Pinkertons. And I said, Mom, why did you call the Pinkertons? Didn't you get my note? That was bad. And my mom said, yeah, we got the note. We got the car. It's in the shop. We should have let you tutor in the Bronx. And now where are you going? I said, well, I'm just going west. I'm following this dream now. And she said, boy, that's really something else. Where are you going to stay? And I said, well, I would like to stay at Little George's. My cousin George Lamont had done a couple of tours of duty in Vietnam, and he was living in the Mission District in San Fran. So she said, 4 Chenery Street, and I wrote that down, and I got out to the Mission District. I played classical guitar in Hispanic restaurants. I joined the Nichiren Shosho Buddhists and chanted Nam-myoho Renge Kyo with my beads, and it was kind of really mystical, and I had a Japanese-American mentor there named Gus, who'd been interned during World War II in Hawaii, and it was great. I was not ever going to college. I didn't need college. No way. I was happy sleeping on George's floor. But I drew a bad draft number, and I had to call the people at Reed, and I said, look, I know I turned you down 5 months ago, but you got to open up a spot for me, because I just don't feel like going over to Vietnam. And they opened up a spot for me. So about 7 in the morning, in front of the Nichiren Shosho Temple on Market and Chenery with George and Gus and a bunch of other people, I was presented with a Gohon Zone. Yep, Gohon Zone, which is a Japanese scroll. And Gus explained it to me a little bit. Then I took the Market Street bus downtown in San Francisco, got off somewhere near Golden Gate Park and walked the rest of the way, walked across the park to Big Park and got to the base of the bridge. And I walked up on the base on the left on the pedestrian side there. And it was a silvery gray mist. I could only see about, 3 feet in front of my nose. And I got sort of to the middle of the bridge, and I heard some shuffling to my left. And I squinted and I looked over, and there were the contours of the face of a young man with stringy blonde hair. And I thought he was kind of looking a lot like the guy I saw in my dream. And I couldn't figure it out. Because I'd had the dream 2 years ago and 3,000 miles away. So this was kind of crazy. And I looked at him and he looked at me. And I said to him, I truly hope that you're not planning to jump. And he got really upset because I'd interrupted him. He was leaning out on the ledge. There's a railing on the bridge that's about waist high. Now it's about face high because they want to keep people from jumping off. But at that time it was about waist high, so anyone could step over it. And he'd stepped over, and he was on the ledge, and he was leaning out, ready to jump. And then he just indignantly screamed at me, "Life is empty nothingness," which was basically a line from Macbeth. And I told him that it sounds a lot more realistic when you're out there on a ledge about to jump into the San Francisco Bay than it did when we used to do Macbeth at Memorial Hall at St. Paul's in New Hampshire. And he was a smart guy. We struck on a little conversation. I said, look, I just want you to know that it's possible that I came all the way out here to meet you. And he couldn't believe it. So he said, tell me about that. And I explained the dream. I explained the argument at home. I explained the Bill de Bono. I explained driving west in the Mercedes and leaving it in the middle of Pennsylvania with a note and all of that stuff. And I said, so I think, because you look so much exactly like the guy in my dream, I just think that somehow it was my destiny to be here and meet you. And so he was still, agitated. And I said, look, his name was Harry. I said, I've got something that can turn your life around. He said, what's that? And I said, it's a Gohon Zone. And I pulled my Gohon Zone scroll out of my little backpack. And I said, look, this is a Buddhist scroll, and whoever possesses it will have good luck the rest of their life. I just been told that, like, you know, an hour earlier. So I said, if you come over the ledge, come here by me. I'm going to explain the symbols, and I'm going to give this to you, and I'm going to let you take it, but you have to make me a promise. You have to take this note. I wrote him a note to my cousin George. This is Harry. Please let him sleep on your floor. Or I was. Bring him down to the temple. Let him meet Gus and try to take care of him. And so I explained the symbolism of the Gahon Zone about universal mind and internal peace and security and kindness. And Harry was really impressed. We chanted a little bit, actually. I taught him to chant something. And then I said, look, you head south on the bridge with this note, and I'm going north up to Oregon. And as we parted ways, all that mist, that silvery gray mist, evaporated, and the sun was up, and it was a beautiful blue sky. And I just had the feeling that I had just had this incredible moment of, you know, what what you might call synchronicity, where somehow I was guided in this sort of premonitional dream through a whole series of uncanny events that had to line up almost perfectly. And I had met the person I was supposed to meet on the bridge. And I thought, you know what? That dream had meaning after all. I wasn't sure. Like I said, I wasn't sure. But now I thought it didn't. I believe that my mind from then on was connected, was part of a larger mind. And Harry, by the way, did go to George's, and he did get it together that summer. And I never saw him again, but I came back at Thanksgiving and heard all about it. He'd gone back home to North Carolina. He was okay, at least at the time. So for me, that was a really powerful event, because it kind of shifted my life from just kind of being curious about this idea of a one mind to really thinking of it as a certainty. And I got a ride up, you know, up to Oregon in a farmer's truck, and that's episode one.
Wow. Do you feel that that man was the guy in the dream, and that the message of if you save him, you too shall live? Do you feel that that was applicable to the moment?
It was a what? I'm sorry.
Do you feel that it was applicable, representative, that moment was representative of that, if you save him, you too shall live message?
Oh, yeah. I thought it was, you know, that somehow this dream, totally uncanny, had a lot more meaning than I had ever anticipated, because absolutely, it seemed to have come true. I mean, Harry looked identical to the person I saw in the dream, and if you ever read a book like Larry Dossey's One Mind or any of these things, you know, what you get is this sense that there is this kind of supreme being or infinite mind that precedes all matter and is beyond space and time, and therefore it's possible I could have had a dream when I was 15 that was kind of a premonition of an encounter that was set up in synchronicity for 2 years later and 3,000 miles away. Yeah, I think it was. I think the dream came true. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, regarding the one mind aspect, or, you know, like Jungian collective consciousness. Do you feel that we are, when you look at what kind of was laid out before you, and how things unfolded, and, you know, the choices that you made that led you to get to that particular point, to have that moment, do you feel that you were following a predestined path, or do you feel that you were kind of shown that, and then that maybe fed into your decision making leading you there? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I was lured, you know, it wasn't predestined, although I, you know, I believe in destiny, but I had the responsibility unwittingly to some degree, you know, to do what I did. I mean, I decided that when the car broke down, I could have thought, well, you know what? That's a sign that, by the way, some months later, I'd be taking a course on Alchemy 101 with Steve Jobs and Reed. But let me just say that the car, I could have said, well, this is a sign that I'm not supposed to go on this journey. And I could have, you know, flagged the police that morning and maybe somehow gotten things straightened out and eventually driven home. I don't know. But no, I took it as a sign that I wasn't supposed to turn around, do a U-turn, go home. I was supposed to go west. And so that was something that was up to me. And there were many other things. I mean, when I gave Harry the Gajon Zone, you know, that wasn't in the in the dream, but that was the only thing I had. I mean, he was, you know, I pulled it out, and you know, it was interesting enough. I mean, they're about 3 or 4 feet long, and they've got a lot of nice symbols on them. And I explained a couple of symbols, the two that I knew, and you know, somehow it worked out. You know, but I was also empathic. I was trusting. I was not being in any way aggressive or disrespectful. I was able to kind of walk Harry over the railing, and so yeah, if you save him, you too shall live. I felt as I walked north that that was true, that somehow in helping Harry I'd helped myself. Maybe we're all one in consciousness, and so when we help anyone, we're also helping ourselves inevitably. I don't know. But I felt that way, and I felt really blessed and guided, and I was smiling. And then this old farmer's truck came by, and a guy flung that door open and said, "Where are you going?" I said, "Oregon." He said, "Jump in. My name is Dwayne Dill, D-I-L-L, just like in Dill Pickle. And this here's my wife, Dorothy." And she was a red-haired woman in the passenger seat. And I got in. There's like a Ford pickup truck with some chicken coop on the back. And so they drove me most of the way up to Oregon. But, yeah, I felt like somehow this was all supposed to happen. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, very much so. Well, we're about halfway through the show, Stephen, so I want to take a quick break. And I do want to invite listeners, if you would like to call in and ask Stephen any questions, you can call in at 619-789-4359. And for those listening live in the chat room, if you have any questions, feel free to pose them. And then when we come back, Stephen, I want to talk a little bit about the dream aspect and kind of how did your feeling about dreams and their role in being able to kind of guide us, okay?
Okay, good.
Okay, great. Everyone stay tuned. We'll be right back after this brief break.
Hello, this is Robert Sharp. I want to thank you for joining us and hope that you are enjoying today's show. Just a reminder that we have a wealth of information and resources available on our website, biteradio.me. There is a calendar of upcoming shows, along with an archive link that will give you access to more than 1,400 shows we have had over the past 9 years. Also on the site is a link to the products and services we provide: books, photography, a wellness store, and self-publishing assistance. Our show is a free podcast on iTunes, Blog Talk Radio, iHeartRadio, and TuneIn. And you can subscribe for free on any of those platforms by using the links on our website homepage. We are on many social media platforms: Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, etc. And we also have buttons to those platforms at the top of our homepage. Our website, biteradio.me, has much for you to explore and enjoy. I also very much appreciate you supporting our guests. and especially today's guest. And now, back to the show.
Okay, everyone, thank you for staying with us. Again, today, my very special guest is Dr. Stephen G. Post, and we've been talking about his new book, God and Love on Route 80, The Hidden Mystery of Human Connectedness, A Story of Faith, Love, and Destiny for Everyone on a Spiritual Journey. Again, you can find out more about Stephen and his books and information by visiting his website, which is stephengpost.com, stephengpost.com. And you can also find out more by visiting the website on limitedloveinstitute.org. Okay, so with that, we're back, Stephen.
Okay, Robert.
Okay, great. So as I mentioned before we left about dreams, so with this particular dream, this was a recurring dream of yours. Have you had other recurring dreams, or are you one of the type of people who have good recall of dreams? What's your take on the value of dreams?
You know, very sporadically, you know, two or three times a year, I will have a really vivid dream that I think has some meaning and significance. But otherwise, I'm not a big dreamer. I just don't have lots of dreams. I sleep pretty soundly. I think that some dreams are just, you know, we make them up because we're nervous about things, and it's somehow a way of processing that emotion. Maybe some dreams come about because finally we're solving a problem that's been vexing, and the answer just crystallizes and we have a dream about it. But I also think there's this third kind of dream, which is where we really are invaded in a very vivid way by a higher cherishing spiritual reality with which we are all connected, each and every one of us without exception. So I'm not a big dreamer, and that's why those dreams when I was 15 were so striking, because you know, they recurred, they were exactly the same, and I wasn't quite sure about the meaning of it, but it was powerful enough to leave me with an intuition that, you know, maybe I should actually follow the dream and see what this is about.
Yeah, absolutely. So now the book is comprised of 13 episodes or chapters. So can you tell us how you chose those particular topics? How did you go about the, you know, making the selection of what to include? Because I'm sure it's over an extended period of time.
Well, it's not a memoir, you know. I kept my kids out of it, you know, just to protect them. You know?
They were happy.
But, you know, they were happy actually, because this is Dad, you know. But when I, for example, when I got up to read late in the, I chose these episodes because they illustrated how this universal mind connects us in love, and so I was. At Reed, it was late January. Doesn't snow up there in Oregon, but it rains a lot, and it can get slushy on a cold night. So it was a late Saturday night, and I'm in the coffee shop. It's 9 o'clock, and a guy with a black motorcycle jacket comes bounding in, and he's a little bit lit up, and he says, "I'm Andy. I've got a brand new Harley Davidson Shovelhead, fastest bike of its day. Who wants to go for a ride?" And like a complete fool, I said yes, and I went out there and I jumped on this thing. I grabbed hold of Andy, and he lit up out of there. He had 140 in roughly a minute. He went through all the red lights, all the stop signs. Then at 180, he went down the Pacific Coast Highway, and I'm screaming, let me off!" But he's just yelling into the night, and the cold rain is pelting us. And I really thought I was dead. We were slipping around in the slosh. And eventually, believe it or not, he actually did a Evel Knievel style turn over the midway, and he headed back super fast, and well, he dropped me off exactly where he had picked me up exactly, and I was completely shell-shocked. I had no balance. I staggered over a bridge across the ravine to Ackerman Dormitory, and I never answered the payphone in the dormitory, but as soon as I crossed the threshold, now mind you, it's now 11 at night, West Coast, so it's 2 in the morning, East Coast. Crossed the threshold, and there was a payphone on the right wall, and I never answered that. I'd given the number to my mom when I got to read, but I never answered it, picked it up or anything. Somehow I felt almost compelled, pushed to pick it up. I picked it up and I said, hello, and it was my mom, and she was calling from New York, and she said I was sleeping, and I had this incredible fear and premonition that you were dead, and I was shaking, and are you okay? And I said, well, Mom, I am okay, kind of, but I just had one of the most frightening experiences of my life. And I told her about Andy and the bike and everything, and then we started talking about how amazing it is that, you know, a mother and a son could be connected in this way, although it's not uncommon. I mean, it's not uncommon. In fact, if you look at it, it's, by the way, it's not dads who have these premonitions about their sons and daughters. It tends to be moms, which tells you something about a mother's heart, I guess. But she was 3,000 miles away, and she had this really vivid feeling, and I could say, Mom, I'm not dead, but I thought I was dead, and you know, it was quite remarkable. So that's an episode in and of itself that I go into pretty extensively. You know, and then there are other ones. I mean, a little later in the book, I'm in my mid-50s. I'm in Cleveland, Ohio. I've raised a family in Shaker Heights, an inner ring suburb. I've taught at Case Western Medical School for about 20 years, and I've gotten an invite to come to Stony Brook on Long Island to their medical school, and lo and behold, I got really cold feet about it. All of a sudden, I'm realizing, gosh, we're leaving home. We were in University Circle near the art museum, and it was about 11 at night. I'm standing there with my friend Tom Frutig, who's still around, and he was angry that I was leaving. He thought I hadn't finished my work in Cleveland. He was probably right. Anyway, I had a lot of doubts about it, but it was too late. I mean, I'd already quit Case Western and already signed on the dotted line for Stony Brook. And so I was just really not feeling quite good about this. And we're behind the hotel, and 11 at night, and lo and behold, this African-American man, an elderly African-American man, comes out from the shadows, actually next to the Barking Spider bar. And Tom and I are sitting outside at a table. The coffee shops have now closed down. This guy approaches me, and he's got a stick in his hand. It's like sort of, you know, head high, and it's got some beads on it and things, and it's kind of ornately carved. I can see as he gets closer. And he walks right up to me, and he says, you know, I had a dream. I just live off the distance here in University Circle, and I carve sticks for a living, and they call me the shaman of Cleveland, and that's actually true. He's been in the newspapers, and he said, I had a dream, and I want you to take this stick because I think you're going on a long journey, and you're going to need a stick, a staff, because it's going to know more about where you should go than you will. So I said, wow. And my friend Tom, who was standing next to me, said, we want this. And I said, so how much? He said, $40. And I didn't have $40 in my wallet. So Tom actually forked out the money. I paid him back some months later when I was back in town. And so those kinds of events, and I go into that in a lot of detail. You know, I have the stick right in my office. I'm in the medical school. I keep it by my bookcase, you know. When I'm doing a Zoom thing, a video thing, I bring it out and show people. But yeah, I mean, those kinds of events are really uncanny, and they're really powerful. And what they point to is that somehow each one of us is very cherished in this life. And, you know, the namaste is a good statement. I honor the divine in you, and you honor the divine in me. And there is a divine in all of us, and we just don't see it. But hopefully this will contribute to a kind of awareness.
Yeah, that's good. You know, it's the wonderful part of the book is that it's of the so much of the journey was like never in the plan, you know, and that, you know, that it, so much of it was just going toward the unknown, you know, and I think that's one of the values of the book is that, you know, people who are apprehensive about, you know, doing, you know, following that gut, you know, or doing something that they wanted to do but have never done, you know, that the book is a good way for people to recognize the value in just going for it.
Yeah, and the idea that, you know, you don't actually make your life. And now, you know, I've taught at medical school, Chicago, Ann Arbor, 20 years case, and now here I run into a lot of people who are very clear in their vision for their life, and they go from one step to the other,
mm-hmm.
and they think of themselves as being self-made. But I don't look at life that way. I think that we really we have a responsibility to respond to the people who are somehow placed in our path on our journey by a higher power. So I believe in a more a kind of responsive life. I'm not making my life, but I'm responding to a lot of people and things and events, hopefully with grace and love and kindness and creativity. But that's what it is. So,
yeah.
So you don't really make your life, and you need to trust that somehow there is a highway.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've never let my own little goals dominate my life. You know, I mean, most St. Paul's kids go to Wall Street. They go to law school. They do whatever they do. J.P. Morgan was a graduate of St. Paul's years and years and years ago. But no, I mean, I was just going to not have a lot of personal goals, and I was going to follow my dream, and I would respond, you know, thoughtfully. You know, by the way, even when I was 24, I was at the at University of Pennsylvania doing a doctorate in immunology and giving lectures and running a lab. And believe it or not, it's another moment, I quit science to go to the University of Chicago Divinity School to study with Mircea Eliade, who'd written Shamanism, and Joseph Campbell was a visiting professor there at the time, and all kinds of people. And I actually got to sit down in the basement of the Swift Hall dining room and tell Mircea Eliade and Joseph Campbell, who, you know, wrote Man, the Hero with a Thousand Faces, about my dream, about the car, and about the bridge. And Campbell said, "It's synchronicity, not luck." And Mircea Eliade said, "Is everything synchronicity?" Real question. But I got to hang out for 4.5 years with that crowd and became a distinguished university fellow. And, you know, and so I've tried to follow the dream, and I still follow the dream. You know, I mean, life can get a little difficult at times for anybody, but I always have faith in the dream, and I follow the dream, and I'm doing that to this day.
Yeah. Yeah, that was an interesting question, whether all of it makes it work, but those particular moments that we experience as extraordinary are certainly do help us with the writers. And matter of fact, one of the lines from your book that I really liked, and I just made note of, was very much like that. It says, "We take the journey so that we can encounter others who are placed in our path and for good works." So I just thought, you know, that's a very non-selfish worldview, you know. I mean, as far as that, you know, The purpose of the journey is for us, for those encounters, either routine or prearranged, but just for those encounters to happen, and then for something to be, I guess, exchanged or learned or awareness created.
Our job is to respond. You know, with some discretion, but to respond and that's kind of how I've run my life, and I've done pretty well at it. For example, starting the Institute for Research on Unlimited Love, that was amazing to run into Sir John Templeton, the great philanthropist, and to be able to get that going. And it's just the people that you meet who are so astonishing in life, and to value them and to see meeting them as an invitation for growth. So that's how I've been able to get through the years, and I'm happy. I'm content, and I don't feel as though I get some resistance. This is a very spiritually oriented book, and so it's not metaphysically physicalist or materialist, whatever word you want. And, a lot of people think that to be a scientist today, especially at the universities I've been at, which are pretty profound ones, that to be a scientist, you have to be a materialist. But I don't think so at all. The reason I wrote God and Love on Route 80 in part was just because I knew there are a lot of people I've known who have had these kinds of uncanny experiences that are too perfectly set up, not to be caused by some higher level of causality. But they're afraid to speak a word about this because, they're inhibited since it's such a materialistic culture that they live in. But I wanted to free them up and disinhibit them and let them talk about their journeys a little bit more so that they could be happier and have a sense that, okay, maybe there really is a loving God who has their back.
Yeah. The idea of science and the materialistic view of something, of the subject, for example, of love, that's one of those things where sometimes science isn't the proper tool to measure, validate, do the things that science does, things in life, but that, it seems that now with, quantum science, quantum physics and other advances, that it seems that the scientific support for some of the more Eastern philosophies are coming up. And it's strange because it's like they were once one, then separated, and now they're coming back together again.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And so you got a lot of great people these days. I mean, Larry Dossey wrote the foreword to God and Love on Route 80, and it's a beautiful foreword. It's brief, but it just points out that this idea of a infinite one mind that precedes matter is very philosophically respectable, not only in the Eastern world, but in the Western world, from, Plotinus all the way to Hegel. And it's not so strange. And most people have not thought that mind derived entirely from tissue, brain, and cells, but there was something unique about mind, itself, and probably all matter derived at some level from mind. So, in the beginning was the mind, in the beginning was the word. That's how these traditions see it all. And underlying all of reality and the thermodynamic constants is this infinite mind of cherishing love. And so, this is what I think we're learning, and and you know, Rupert Sheldrake's books on morphological fields and so forth. There's a lot of really great stuff out. And physicists are interesting because, you know, I hang around a lot of biologists because I'm in medical schools, and you know, they're much
right.
more skeptical about this than the physics people. But the physics people,
right.
like, you know, two-thirds of them have no problem with this. I mean, I've talked about this stuff with Paul Davies, who won the Templeton Prize for writing his book, The Mind of God. You know, I've spoken about it with John Barrows of Trinity College, Cambridge, you know, who debates Stephen Hawking, or did. So, you know, I mean, the physics people are very open-minded about this, because to say that, well, you had a dream that was beyond time and place, to the, you know, first of all, they don't even know what time is. It's a difficult category, but they're not sure it's real,
right.
you know. And as far as space and place and location, a lot of them believe that there's a kind of non-local dimension to mind, that we do have some, you know, I mean, great physicists, you know, have had incredible creative inspirations where they saw a formula for something. Ramanujan in India
mm-hmm.
wrote all the formulas for quantum physics. His two notebooks were in the center of Trinity College Library, and that was about 1901, 1902. And he was just a, you know, teenager worshiping his goddess, and he wrote these formulas down in the dirt. And later on, he'd come back and he'd write them in a notebook. And, you know, he was obviously brilliant, and that's the basis of quantum physics. And so if you really think about it, you know, maybe the mind is a lot more mysterious, and this idea that we're somehow connected with an infinite mind is a pretty mm-hmm. reasonable idea.
Yeah, I agree. Well, it's reductive. End of the show, Stephen, but I did want to just mention and talk just a little bit about your other book, Why Good Things Happen to Good People, How to Live a Longer, Happier, Healthier Life by the Simple Act of Giving. It's the book is, well, I guess, 11 years old now, so, but it's a message that is timeless. So would you mind kind of sharing, you know, what that book's about, and if the listeners, you know, what the listeners can get by reading the book.
Yeah. Well, that's a book I, you know, I've studied for a long time about the benefits of being generous and living by the golden rule and helping others. And so that book, which Random House published, was a bestseller for a while. It's a little bit dated now, but it's also a timeless book. And so I still work around the country on this topic, and you see helping others being recommended in clinical settings for adolescents with psychiatric issues or addiction issues, in geriatric clinics for older adults. So the more you can see this science getting that sort of traction, the better off we are
mm-hmm.
as a society. Of course, you know, intentionally, you're helping other people. I mean, you're not thinking, well, what's in it for me?
Right.
As a byproduct, a side effect, in most cases, people will report feeling healthier. They will report feeling happier. They will self-report more ability to get through loss and disappointment. They'll self-report better sleeping, more meaning, more gratification in life, and a whole lot of other things. And so it's good to be good, and science says it's so, and you could even say 'tis better to give than to receive, you know, within limits. Yeah, but that's what that book is about. It's
yeah.
a great story.
Wow, you know, and like you said, it's a timeless message. And well, Stephen, I've really enjoyed speaking with you today. It's really been a fun chat.
Thank you, Robert.
Learning and sharing God and love on Route 80. So now, if people want to get in touch with you, would the best be to go through the website stephengpost.com, or how so?
Yeah, my email is there, and also if you buy the book, you know, Amazon got it and all, you know, that's great. You know, pick it up And then my phone number and email are in the back of the book, and you can actually email me.
Perfect. Well, thank you for your time.
Pleasure, Robert.
G. Post.
Hey, wishing you well. Take care. Okay, good.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
You as well. So, bye-bye. Again, everyone, today my very special guest has been Dr. Stephen G. Post, and we've been talking about his book, God and Love on Route 80, The Hidden Mystery of Human Connectedness, A Story of Faith, Love, and Destiny for Everyone on a Spiritual Journey. And again, you can find out more by visiting his website, which is stephengpost.com, and that's Stephen with a P-H, stephengpost.com. And you can also find out more by visiting the website unlimitedloveinstitute.org. So everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration Show. Until we meet again, thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth Show. Remember, our show is available as a free podcast from Blog Talk Radio, iTunes, TuneIn, and iHeartRadio. To follow our show, visit our homepage at byteradio.me and select the platform you use most. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at ByteRadioMe. Until we meet again, remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.